So I wanted to open it up to the audience and see if anybody has any questions.
I have two questions. They're kind of related. What do you have an opinion about why there was nobody who really took up the mantle of leadership in the Black community after Martin Luther King died? And related to that one, do you have an opinion about the impact this had on Jesse Jackson and what his experience and what came of his life following the assassination?
Well, I think Jackson tried to take up the mantle. And, you know, I talk a little bit about how Jackson tried to take up the mantle, you know, within hours, within minutes of the assassination. And I don't want to give that away other than to say that he didn't, you know, he's had a very interesting career and he's done amazing things, but he didn't acquit himself very well that day, April 4th, with the bloody shirt and all the claims of him dying in his arms and all that. I think people have tried to take up the mantle, but, you know, it's a testament to how amazing King was, I think, that no one was successful. King, some combination of his smarts, his eloquence, his ability to speak so many different dialects of American language, the way he could move effortlessly into, you know, all these different situations, his savvy as a political strategist. There's just no one that really came close after that. You know, some of the lieutenants that he had, I was most impressed by Andrew Young. I think he maybe came closest and certainly had quite a career afterwards. But it's also possible that, you know, the movement had come to not an end by any means, but a kind of a stasis. It was fraying in many different directions. There were lots of different ideas about where the movement was supposed to go, whether it goes into economic issues, social issues. But the main obvious victories in terms of public accommodations, voting, and so forth, basic civil rights, had been won. And so even King in his last years was a little bit unsure which way the movement should go. You see that in those last 2 years or so where he's experimenting with different things and he's got some fairly radical notions about redistributing wealth in America that are not very popular, and he's very controversial. So I think that whoever would have taken up the mantle would have had a hard time enjoying the kind of clarity that the movement had in its early days.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for Blood and Thunder.
Thank you.
For me personally, it was one of those books that kind of became a life changer. So thank you. You mentioned all of the identities that James Earl Ray had. Was there any evidence that you found that he had more than one personality?
Well, you know, there are times when I thought that he had sort of the beginning of a multiple personality disorder. There were ways in which he inhabited these different names and changed his dress and changed his glasses and changed his hair and changed his nose. That made me think that, you know, that maybe he had that, the beginning of it. But I'm not a psychiatrist. I don't know enough about that disorder to be able to fully say whether he had that. But he also had trouble sometimes recognizing when the different personalities had exposed themselves to each other. For example, near the end of the story, when he's caught in London, he's insisting that he's not James Earl Ray, even though they have his fingerprints and they've got a lot of evidence against him. And so he's given this court-appointed barrister in London to handle the extradition proceedings, a very dignified English lawyer. And the lawyer says, you know, how can I help you? What can I do for you while we're waiting for the proceedings to take place? And he said, now he was known as, at this point, he called himself Ramon George Snade. Ramon George Snade. S-N-E-Y-D, Snade. And he called himself Sir Snade. And he insisted that he was not James Earl Ray. So the barrister says, how can I help you? What can I do? And he said, well, I would like for you to contact my brother back in the United States. Sure, no problem. How can I reach him? What's his name? Jerry Ray. And, you know, this lawyer was just like, is this guy stupid? I mean, he didn't betray any feeling of like he'd really exposed himself in any way. But he absolutely insisted that he was not James Earl Ray, even when he came on a special plane, Air Force plane from London and landed in Memphis in the summer of 68. He still was calling himself Snade. So I don't know. You know, the story that he gave after he confessed and plea bargained and all this, he recanted his confession 3 days later and said that he had done all these things that he'd been accused of, except for the pulling the trigger part. That was done by a guy named Raoul, the mysterious Raoul. And I'm convinced that this guy Raoul was, you know, just another one of these identities that he cooked up. It may have been a composite of various people he had known, or maybe he was trying to protect someone like his brothers. Yet another identity is what I'm trying to say here. You know, it's like this is a guy who spent his whole criminal career creating identities, and he was doing it even after he'd, you know, been caught. And but he stuck with that Raoul story for really till the day he died. He changed it a lot. And this Raoul went from being a guy from Montreal to being this Portuguese guy, and, you know, he was Spanish for a while, Latin American. But he stuck with the Raoul story, and I think it's a testament to our hunger for conspiracies that the Raoul story has stuck, because there's not a shred of evidence that this guy ever existed. You know, it's just it's a mysterious sounding name, Raoul. You know, that's about all you have.
In your talking about carrying King's mantle, I'm curious that you didn't mention Congressman John Lewis, who,
yes,
from everything that I have read, I mean, he was even more radical, but he was very close, and he's constantly working on carrying out the beloved community, the whole teaching of nonviolence. And
yeah,
I was just wondering, because I hold him in such high,
yeah,
esteem, if you talked to him at all in the course of your research, or who, well, else do you talk to in your research?
I didn't talk to John Lewis, only because he really wasn't involved in these last few days, last few weeks of King's life. I didn't go into Selma. I didn't go into some of the great things that he did with King. You know, there's been amazing books about, you know, biographies of King that really, highly recommend Taylor Branch's trilogy of King, in which John Lewis plays an important role. I would love to talk to him, though. I mean, you know, I don't think, you know, I just don't think he didn't know anything particular about what was happening in Memphis. He wasn't in Memphis. I do agree that he's one of the stalwarts. He's one of the great ones. He's done great things, and sometimes I don't think of him as being so. How to put this? I mean, it's like he sort of quietly, patiently, stubbornly built this career, which is so admirable. Where, you know, he wasn't a preacher, he wasn't trying to, you know, draw attention to himself. He was trying to do things with his career and change laws. And I think he has done that very much so. But I mean, God, the bravery that he showed in Selma. I mean, that's. You know, he's an American hero. I mean, there's no question about it. I guess I thought of, when I said Andrew Young, I was thinking about his sort of immediate Southern Christian Leadership Conference entourage. And of all those, I think Young was the one who went on to great things the most. Abernathy, of course, took over right after King was assassinated and did some extraordinary things as well. But again, the movement was changing. The next thing that they did after King died, the Poor People's Campaign in Washington was not very successful. It was an interesting experiment, and it had some high moments, but it was a failure, I think, in many ways. And that figures into my story, actually. And I guess John Lewis was involved in Poor People's Campaign a little bit, but anyway, I'm glad you brought him up. He's a great man.
I'm thinking of him, Martin Luther King Jr., as the man, and as his ability to have a worldview and inspire people, mm-hmm, in the same way that Kennedy could inspire people.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they both seemed to think that their private lives wouldn't have any bearing on what they are doing. And there seems to be a blind spot with some of these great great people that have this wonderful ability, and yet they don't realize what they're doing to their family or even to the movement. Mm-hmm. And then the second part is he was such an easy target on the balcony at the Lorraine Motel. It seems to me that he did have a death wish, or he knew that he would soon die.
Okay, well, the first thing, you know, I don't dwell on it by any means, but I don't ignore it. He did have a weakness for women. He had dalliances. He had mistresses. This is well known. It's not talked about very much because it's a very delicate thing to talk about, a Nobel laureate and a person who has a national holiday named after him, to realize that he also had this issue. I mean, it may not have been as bad as Hoover thought it was, for example, but he did have this problem. And I spoke with one of his mistresses at some great length in Louisville, Georgia Davis, who's a very nice person and a very absolutely credible person. He had other mistresses in other cities. His marriage with Coretta was troubled by that point. There's no question about it. A combination of all of his travels and all the stresses on his life, and these dalliances. I don't know why. I don't really speculate on like why it is that these leaders who are so charismatic and so powerful, and in his case, powerful only by virtue of his message. He wasn't a senator. He wasn't a CEO of anything. He wasn't particularly wealthy. He's just the moral force of his personality and the charisma and his eloquence is what made him, I think, so desirable to so many women. And who knows why? You know, and he certainly was aware. He's in his last speeches and last sermons in the last years of his life. He spoke a lot about, you know, there are two selves and we have to hold the better self up and try to. You know, he seemed to grapple with his, you know, his own weaknesses, and was profoundly aware of them. And he wasn't anything as crazy. I mean, I read the book on, what's it called, The Dark Side of Camelot, Seymour Hersh's book about JFK. I mean, it wasn't anything crazy like erotic asphyxiation or, you know, hookers and crazy stuff that JFK did. He had long-term relationships with mistresses in many cities, women he loved and respected and who were intellectually his equal, and he wasn't a sexual adventurer in quite the way that, say, JFK and RFK were. The second part of your question was about what an easy target he was. It's, you know, I think people who think about King now we know that he is a national, international figure who is a national holiday. We assume that he must have had bodyguards and that he must have had a secret service and that he must have had a big entourage of people with him who were shielding his movements. But you know, we forget that he was a private citizen. When he was offered police details, he usually declined them. Often because he said they would probably just spy on me, which they, of course, probably were. He didn't have any federal, you know, entourage. He didn't have any. The FBI was spying on him. They weren't protecting him. He personally did not believe in guns. He didn't believe that any of his group should carry guns or any other kind of weapon. He thought it sent out all the wrong signals. This is a guy who built his life on nonviolence and staked his entire reputation on Gandhian principles, and he wasn't going to try to project this macho image with all these armed guys. The best he did is he had some football players, big dudes who walked around with him sometimes that were part of the SCLC. But he wasn't. He did not have a death wish. I don't agree with that. People have said that to me. I think there may have been times where he was very resigned to the fact that I'm going to die. I'm probably going to get killed. He got death threats all the time, including the night before he came to Memphis. The day he came to Memphis. Excuse me. There was a bomb threat on the plane from Atlanta. He thought about it all the time. He didn't want it to completely alter the way he lived his life. he could have quit now. You know, one of the things he could have done is just stopped and taken a sabbatical and become a university president or a, you know, a diplomat or something. He could have done something very different. But and in that sense, he couldn't stop what he was doing. He was so closely tied to the movement that he didn't see any other way. And I think in that sense, he knew that the odds were pretty good that he was going to get killed. He talked about it all the time, including his last speech. You know, I may not get there with you, and these are the sick white brothers that are out there. And it was very present in his mind. So, but I don't know specifically about the site at the Lorraine. How many of you have been to the National Civil Rights Museum, the Lorraine? A lot of you. It's a very exposed place. It's hard to imagine a more exposed place than that museum, than that at the time motel. Standing out on that balcony, you know, the angles, you know, the vantage points for a possible sniper were endless. And so he must have, you know, it is kind of amazing that he lingered there for not 1 minute, not 2 minutes, but something like 6, 7, 8 minutes. And, you know, that's what got him killed in this case. But it could have been anywhere else. I mean, everywhere he went, all these marches, he was exposed. He was out there. He put himself out there every day. And I think about that a lot, is just how brave he was and how, you could say it's a death wish, but I think it's more of a just a feeling that this is the only way that he can make his case, is by physically being there and being out there amongst the marchers and confronting policemen and tear gas and dogs and, you know, the whole thing. The physicality of it was important. And so on that moment, I think it was just I think he lost track of time. He was having a good time. He was actually having a very good day. He was very jovial. He had won a victory in court. He was joking with his staff. He was about to go have some soul food, a big dinner. He was all very excited and in a very good mood, and I think he lost track of time. And if someone had just said, get off of there, 1 minute earlier, history might have been different. We have time for maybe one more.
Yeah, last question.
Last question. I think it was only after you had mentioned that you're writing a book or completing one on a polar expedition, and it's an American expedition, that began to see the word trail on Hellhound, and then thinking of the Santa Fe Trail and the Oregon Trail in Blood and Thunder, and then the Death March. And I'm wondering if...
I do death marches, basically, yeah.
I wonder if you thought of yourself in a particularly... American strain of American literature and history writing, where history is seen as being made on the road or being made on trails. And King was on the move all the time, and mm-hmm. and Ray was, of course, as a guy on the lam, Kit Carson, the Death Marches. Mm-hmm. Do you see that as simply a coincidence, or do you feel that you're chronicling various American experiences seems to take you at least to that mm-hmm. to that one theme of expedition and road and discovery and travel and being on the lam and hunting Indians and James Earl Ray's down?
Wow, that's really profound. I appreciate it's a good analysis. I think it's.
I'm an English.
Oh, you're okay. Okay, well, that explains it. Well, you know, the thing is though that I think it's not so much that I consciously gravitate to stories about being on the road, but I do think that I'm interested in narrative history, and you know, conventional history, academic history has a very well-deserved reputation for being deadly dull. I mean, let's just face it. It's like chloroform in print. It can be very, very, very sleepy. It'll put you to sleep. And so you need action. You need movement. You need some sense of, you know, I think of some sort of the difference between a river and a stagnant pond or lake. You know, it's like there's something about a river that's always more interesting. There's twists and turns, and you know, there's a lot more oxygen in the water, you know. And I think that's what good narrative history aspires to do, is to have action and plot. Yes, there's time for reflection and analysis and backing up and explaining how we got on this march and why we're on this march, but I do gravitate towards stories, I guess, that have a lot of plot and have a lot of movement. Because I like to describe landscape. I think character. I think that landscape is probably consistently a character in my book, whether it's the Philippines or the American West or the American South. I'm interested in I've always been drawn to writing about land and weather and, you know, birds and, you know, physical things that you can describe that are part of the setting. I think setting is a big part of narrative history. You know, it's essentially setting and character that make narrative history work. The first writer, period, that I ever met was Shelby Foote in Memphis, the great Civil War historian. And he was really good at describing landscape. And he was certainly, I mean, that book, the trilogy, his Civil War trilogy, is just, it's full of action. It's just nonstop plot. Yeah, there's breathers for character analysis or a little, you know, setup before a big battle. But there's just a lot of action. And I guess that I'm drawn in all these cases to stories about that have a lot of plot. But it does. There was kind of a death march theme I had going there, because I had the death march in Bataan and then the long walk of the Navajo, which was very much a death march. King's story is a series of marches that are sometimes successful, sometimes not. And then this story is the ultimate slog. I mean, gosh, what these men went through in the North Pole, trying to get to the North Pole, well before, this is long before Scott and Amundsen and Shackleton and all of that. This is 1879. It is very much you know, it's a death march, I guess. Although, like I say, there, it's also a survival story. People survive, and it's extraordinary that any of them survived this tale. So in about 2 or 3 years, hopefully I'll be sitting here and we'll be talking, maybe with Mary Charlotte, about the new book. I do kind of have a working title for it on the proposal. It's called Extremes of the Earth, and it's really, you know, at the time they thought they were operating under this really wacky science that was going to, they were going to sail, they were going to bust through a little bit of ice north of Siberia, and they were going to get into the North Pole area, which was supposed to be a warm, shallow sea teeming with life and a lost civilization. And it's sort of indicative of how little was known about this place, that 33 men were willing to ram themselves in the ice and think that they were going to become, you know, glorified heroes. Stick with me. Maybe 2 or 3 years, we'll be back here. Dorothy will be hosting, and it'll be a great event. Thanks for coming tonight.
And once again, we've been listening to a conversation with Hampton Sides at the Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe that took place in March of this year. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.